Welcome to episode 36 of Booty and Bossy Eat, Drink, Knit. We're very excited to have Christina Kading, who is many things, an artist in all sorts of ways. We're going to talk about that. But we met her at Rhinebeck because she had a booth where she was showing us how she made rugs. But we learned in our conversation then that she is also a sheep shearer in addition to a rug maker and an artist. So welcome, Christina. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You mentioned, I remember, that you're a second generation sheep shearer. Can you tell us a little bit about how did you first learn? What was it like growing up?
Yeah, my dad is the first generation because he has an older sister. So my Aunt Diane, when she was a little girl, she wanted to have two sheep so she could do 4-H with her fellow classmates. And my opa got her two sheep, and she started going to 4-H, and she started to get a little bit older into her teens. And by then, two sheep had turned into 100 sheep, and my aunt didn't want to have anything to do with the sheep anymore. She was too busy going out, partying with her friends. She didn't want to be a farmer anymore. She had her fill. So my opa says to my dad, Donald, "Donald, you got to start to learn how to shear these sheep. Go out there." So my dad started shearing sheep with hand shears, the big scissors. Like, I don't know if you've seen the movie Babe, but just like how he sheared that sheep in the field with those hand clippers. That's how my dad started shearing sheep. And then my opa said, "All right, well, I'll get you a pair of electric shears." So my dad ended up making a little group of friends. So there's only four guys that shear sheep in the area. It's me, Donald, Jeff Traver, and Mike Gates. And they all shear in the Hudson Valley region. And that's pretty much it. So those guys have been doing it for 45 years. And my father decided that somebody had to take over the business. So he says to my mother, "Mary Sue, we got to start having kids so my kids can take over the farm." I was the first born child. 11 months after that was my brother, Michael. And then a couple years after that, my brother, Stephen, was born. So now there's three kids, one daughter and two boys to take over the family business. And my two brothers wanted absolutely not a thing to do with the sheep or sheep shearing whatsoever. But I, on the other hand, am always open to keeping myself busy. And I try to be as helpful to anybody that I can. So when my dad needs help on the farm, I'm all ready for it. I may not be in the mood, but you just got to push through. So my dad said, "I think it's time for you to start learning how to shear sheep." And it is hard. I think I was 8 or 9 when I sheared my first sheep. Well, tried to shear my first sheep. And it is a hard, hard, hard job.
I cannot imagine.
Usually I'm used to being like, "Yeah, I could do it," and immediately being good at something. And this is a whole different ball game. So I was a little bit frustrated at first. I was like, "What the heck is this? This doesn't make any sense. Why am I not good at it right off the bat?" My dad tried to explain to me how to shear sheep, but the trick to getting good at shearing is you just have to keep doing it. You're not going to be good at shearing the first sheep or even the fifth sheep or the 10th sheep. My father said after your first 100 sheep, you start to get good at it.
Now, were you using the electric?
Yeah, so I was using the electric shears, and I only used the hand shears when we were getting ready for a show and you had to do the detailed work to make them look really nice with the hand shears. So my dad is not very patient and he isn't a great teacher. So he said there's a school Cornell University does in Ithaca. It's like a weekend thing. You can go to sheep shearing school with Cornell University in March. How do you feel about that? So I said, "Sure, yeah, let's do it."
Now, how old were you at this point?
I was 18.
Oh, okay. So you've been doing it for about 10 years.
I'm 33 now, and I went to sheep shearing school when I was 18.
Oh my God, I thought you were like 25.
No. So I went to the sheep shearing school, and it was still hard.
What was that like?
Oh my gosh. So it's in March. So it's really, really cold. You're in this big barn with all these people that signed up, and there's a few instructors, and they teach you everything. They teach you how to sharpen your blades and how to set up your shears and how to know when to put more tension on the blades and how to work the machines and how to take care of the machines. And they give you the sheet of paper with the steps. So sheep shearing is like a dance.
Is that the Godfrey Bowen, that idea of it's like a ballet? Yeah,
it is. It's like, it really is like a ballet. You have to get your sheep, make it feel comfortable, and sit it on its butt. So there's this certain sweet spot right on the sheep's butt cheek. Like, so it's kind of like sitting right on its side.
So not the tailbone, but kind of off to the side. Little bit. Yeah,
exactly. So like, it's just like a little bit off the side, because if you have the sheep sitting straight up on its tailbone, it'll start kicking,
right?
Because that's uncomfortable. So you have to make sure that the sheep is comfortable. Your knees are always put together. You're always in the squatting position with your knees tight together, because the sheep needs to feel comfortable and secure. Because if the sheep doesn't feel comfortable and secure, it'll start kicking. So they taught you all the steps, how to make the sheep feel comfortable and where to start. So the first step is you got to start shearing the belly. So once you get that sheep comfortable, shear the belly, go in through the crotch area. Then you have to step to the side of the sheep and shear up the back leg, then the neck, then the long strokes down the back, then the left shoulder, and then all the way back down through the tailbone and the last leg.
Wow.
That's the most efficient way to shear a sheep.
I was watching on your Instagram post, and you had a little...
Yeah, so the original video of that is 15 minutes long.
Oh.
We recommend, we'll put a link in our show notes, that everybody should watch this because it's really fascinating.
Yeah.
My question was, I love at the end how you pull up and it's all one piece.
So that's how you know that you did it right. It just is about taking your time and breathing through it, because if the sheep senses that you're rushing or you're stressed or if you're uncomfortable, then it'll start kicking and trying to get up. But that sheep was particularly nice to me. And I do better when no one is watching me. So I was just in the barn alone shearing the sheep. But if I have a client that wants to watch, or if there's kids there and stuff like that, I get stage fright because I'm too distracted by people watching me. But I did a good job shearing that sheep because nobody was around. And I got to take my time with the sheep and really concentrate on how to do it and what to do. So I'm getting better at shearing sheep for sure, but I tap out at 10 sheep. I get too tired after 10 sheep. My legs start shaking because of all the muscles that you have to use. So me and my dad actually split our business 50-50 because people started calling him to shear alpacas and llamas. So he was like, sure, I can shear anything that needs to be sheared. I'll be right over there. So he goes over to shear this alpaca, and he didn't know which way was up. He had no idea how to shear this thing. And he sheared it like a sheep, which is crazy.
Oh, so he laid it on its rump.
He tried to flip this alpaca over and put it on its butt.
Oh no.
And like shear it like a sheep. So he was like, this ain't right.
So how do you shear it?
Yeah, what is the difference in technique?
Oh my gosh, it's so different. So we ended up splitting the business because I would rather shear 100 alpacas than 10 sheep.
Huh. Is it just because it's physically, you're not doing that bending and stuff as much?
I'm still bent over, but we use restraints to keep the alpaca in position instead of using your body to keep the sheep in position. So I have an anchor point on one end of the barn and then another anchor point on the other end of the barn. So I put the block and tackle on the left side, then pull it out, and I put the other anchor point on the right side, and there are loops that go around the wrists and ankles of the alpaca, and you just attach them to the block and tackle and stretch them out. So it's like the medieval torture device.
Oh, wow.
So they're stretched out on the floor. So you shear one side of the alpaca and then just flip them over to the other side and do the other side and move on. It's definitely a two-man job.
to just hold the animal while the other person does the shearing?
Somebody to hold the alpaca while I get the restraints on. And then somebody needs to be there to hold the head while I'm shearing. Because if nobody's at the head while I'm shearing, the alpaca can lift its head up and look around and hit its head on. Some alpacas don't like getting sheared because it's scary. So I have an emotional support person with the alpaca at all times. They do better with that. My specialty is llamas and alpacas. I have about 50 regular clients scheduled every season. And I've been shearing alpacas professionally solo for 10 years.
So when you have somebody who's helping you, is it usually the owner?
No, I bring my brother out. I bring my brother, Steven, or my friend, Christina, comes and helps me. A lot of my friends are always down to come with me to be my assistant for the day, because who doesn't want to hang out with some cute alpacas?
I know.
No, yeah, a lot of people don't realize what they look like when they're not sheared. They look like little aliens. They're like, how do they go from a marshmallow to like that? Their necks are so long and weird. I was like, yeah, that's what it's like.
So your client takes the wool. And then is there a mill, or what do they do with it?
So a lot of my alpaca clients like to keep the fiber and they send it out. So if you have to have a certain amount of wool to be able to make a blanket or something, it'll be a couple of seasons worth of fiber. So a lot of my clients only have two or three alpacas.
Mm.
They're like pets. So 3 out of 50 farms have over 20 alpacas. All the rest of them are just twos and threes, and they're just family pets because they wanted alpacas. They send it all over the place. A lot of people use a wool mill in Connecticut.
So they're sending it out and they're not getting yarn back. They're actually getting some kind of finished product.
Yeah.
And then they can sell that or keep it or whatever.
Exactly.
How do they know that it's from their alpaca?
That's a really good question.
It's trust, blind trust.
That's right. It's trust.
I remember you talking, and I was really interested in this, that you said that there's a lot of waste in how something gets from being on an animal to either yarn or a finished product. Like, how much do you see of that as you're shearing?
Like I said, like a lot of my people only have twos and threes, and they have to save the fiber throughout the years in order to have enough. And if they don't properly store the fiber or the wool, mice gets to it.
Mm.
The elements, the hot, cold moisture of the barn, it'll get moldy, all these things. So I'll go into barns where the fiber from 5 years ago is still there. They just collect all the fiber and just throw it into one pile of the barn. And year after year after year, I just see the pile getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and nothing is being done with the wool at all. And it's too late to do anything with it because the mice have already gotten to it, or it's moldy, or it's been there so long that it's actually disintegrating into dust. Because just people don't get around to finding a place to send it, or they don't have any ideas of what to do with it, but they know that they can do something with it. Because I think a lot of people ended up purchasing alpacas in particular because their fiber is so valuable. They bought two alpacas thinking that they were going to make a lot of money off of the fiber. And then they quickly found out that you need a lot of alpacas to make any kind of money, just like any.
Yeah. Well, it kind of reminds me of, I used to have chickens. Yeah. And we didn't kill them after they stopped laying. So there was a way that we were still feeding and paying for the eggs that we'd eaten 3 years ago in our retirement community of chickens. Yeah, I can kind of see where people get into it. And I mean, they know that they have to shear the alpacas because it's a hygiene thing, right? I think a lot of people don't understand that you have to shear these animals, right? I mean,
yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about what happens if you don't?
So sheep used to shed their own wool thousands of years ago before we domesticated sheep. They would just shed their wool, like by rubbing up against a tree. It would just come off. And certain breeds still do have that gene, but now we have to shear them because in the summertime, they'll overheat because their wool isn't thinning and they can't shed it off. So if we don't shear them, they'll overheat in the summertime. And if you don't shear them in the summertime, then when it comes to be lambing season in the spring, it's a cleaner birth process. So on top of urine and feces and everything like that, you don't want all that to get all over your baby lamb. So you want to have a nice, fresh, clean, sheared sheep for lambing season. I shear for a lot of farm sanctuaries with rescued animals and things like that. And this year it was really sad. They found a sheep that hadn't been sheared in 7 years and it survived. We went over to shear the sheep and 50 pounds of wool came off of this animal.
Wow.
It was incredible. And the reaction of the sheep was just, it just warmed your heart. He didn't know what to do. He just looked at the 50 pounds of wool. He didn't know how to walk after, but it was really a miracle that he survived that long without being sheared.
Because I remember reading that the wool can grow up around the face so that they can't see to eat, or even they can't actually eat because they have so much wool growing all around their snout.
Especially baby doll South Downs, you got to shear those guys. They got wool coming out of their ears. They got wool coming out of their eyeballs. If you don't shear them, they can have a really hard time eating and seeing, and the urine will soak into the wool and go down to their skin. And there's been many occasion where I'll put my shears into the wool and start shearing and just maggots start coming out of the wool because they ended up getting urine burn from not being sheared and the urine soaking through the wool.
With that one it was 7 years, did you have to use the scissor shears instead of the electric?
No, I was able to break through the dreadlocks. It was just one big old dreadlock, really. It was like a turtle shell of wool. It was crazy, but I could have put it on. Like the arms and the legs and the neck were all in one dreaded piece. It was insane.
Wow.
You could just pick up the shell of wool and just like put it there. It's a whole other sheep in one piece.
That's such a great description. I can totally picture that it's like this felted coat that you've just removed off the thing.
If it weren't for the urine and the maggots, then
exactly.
So you found a brilliant way to use some of this, what would have been discarded wool. And you want to tell us about that?
If my clients allow me to take the wool so it's not collecting dust and attracting mice in their barn, between me and my father, we collect all of the wool that isn't wanted. And we pack it all throughout this season and bring it to the wool festival every year to trade for yarn with Bartlett Wool, Bartlett Yarn out of Maine. So at the end of the year, between me and my dad, we have about 1,000 pounds of raw wool, and we end up getting a equivalent amount of yarn for the wool. So we started getting all kinds of yarn. So my dad's whole house was filled with yarn to the brim. He bought a circle loom and he started looming hats. I was like, Dad, there's only so many hats you can make, man. He's like, I like it. I was like, all right, you make your hats, but can I take this yarn and make rugs out of it? We could have a store. We could open up a yarn store. We could do so much with this. What are we doing, man? You're just making hats all day long. He's like, yeah. I was like, for you though. So I was like, Dad, I'm taking the yarn and I'm gonna make a rug business. So he's like, all right, do whatever you want to do, crazy kid. So I bought this tufting gun and I did research on everything that I needed to start making rugs. And everything that you need to start making rugs is everything you need to shear a sheep.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. So the only thing that I had to buy was the gun. I already had the yarn, and all I needed to do was build a frame to stretch the monk's claw. And the rest of it is all sheep shearing material. So the shears that I use to make the rugs soft and smooth and even are just the same shears that I use to shear the sheep.
Oh, wow. I didn't
Yeah.
realize that. Well, now tell us about your designs. We were looking on your website, ChristinaKating.com, and I didn't know that you were also a woodworker. I mean, and I noticed some similarities between your rug designs, but can you take us through where did the woodworking come in?
We weren't sure whether you were started doing the woodworking and then the rugs or...
Yeah, I kind of actually started doing them both at the same time,
Oh.
actually. I started doing the rugs when I moved in with my father, and then I started doing woodworking when I moved out. And I thought that it would be a pretty cool concept to have a Christina Kating home goods situation going on. So I wanted to make tabletops and rugs to match the tabletops. So in this instance, I made this table with this design.
Oh, wow. That's really beautiful.
This geometric circle design with kind of like a star design with different types of wood stain. And I thought it would be cool to make a rug to match that design.
Oh, wow.
Beautiful.
So I made a lot of rugs to go with the tables that I make. So this piece would go with this rug here. I wanted them to all be a part of the same collection when I get ready to do a gallery opening and stuff like that. I want everything to be one as a family. The Christina Kating collection.
The collection. Yes, I love it. I remember you had some things on your website that I thought was really cool where you talked about your inspiration and nature for the sort of geometric things. What were you thinking in terms of the sort of geometry? How do you find inspiration in that?
So I didn't go to art school. I was never really into art in high school or anything like that, but it all just happened because I was sitting at my friend's table and she was an artist. And that's all she did all day long was just draw pictures at her table. I was like, well, I got to start doing something too to keep myself busy in this house. So I started to think back of what I liked to draw. And I went back into math class, like in my brain. I was like, in math class, I hated math, but I loved the tools that they gave you. So I love the protractor. I love my compass and my ruler and my square and like all this stuff. So I used to make geometric designs in math class because I didn't want to learn how to do math. I just wanted to make cool patterns. And then as I got older, I started to notice that patterns in nature and seashells and the veins of leaves and the pattern of the bark on the tree and just the way that the grass grows was all I felt like what I was doing in math class was similar to what I was being shown in nature. And then I was hanging out at my friend's mother's house and she was like, can I see your art? And I said, sure. So she was like, have you ever heard of sacred geometry? And I said, no. What is sacred geometry? She's like, I have a book for you. I was like, okay. So this book is called How the World Was Made. And I opened up the book and it's all about patterns in nature and math and what it means and what it represents. And all this time, I've been drawing these patterns just from my mind's eye. And she handed me this book and everything just clicked at that moment. I was like, this is what is in my brain. This is what I've been seeing and what I've been projecting onto my canvas. And I never knew if it had meaning or what I was doing. I thought I just liked to draw lines. So I started researching and just learning more and more about sacred geometry and what that means for us as humans living on Earth. And it all just comes down to that humans are the same as anything else on this planet, because we're all made of the same mathematical equation. We're all part of this same spinning spiral that is Earth.
I remember on your website, you talked about how we're all connected. So you feel like it's that geometry of that basic math and lines and angles and curves that connects us all.
I guess a lot of my art is like a projection of what you would see if you put something under a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
If you put a cell of some kind under a microscope, you would find the geometry that I draw. And if you put a plop of sand on a steel plate and strum a violin string down the side of it, that leaves a vibration onto the sand that projects geometric pattern. So all vibrations leave a different pattern on a object or an energy field around whatever it is you're trying to portray onto it. And that's why I chose wood as my medium, is because wood is very easy for me to listen to. So I'm not much of a sketcher. I don't really doodle or sketch. I never know what I'm going to do with each piece. So I just get one big slab of wood and I sit on top of it and I look at the wood and I listen to it and I let it tell me what it wants to say. Because each slab of wood has its pattern embedded into it. So I just let the flow of the wood speak to me. So I sit on top of it with my ruler and my protractor, and I go into this trance and just let it tell me what it wants to do. And I just go with the flow, trust the process, and it all ends up working out in the end.
Have you ever heard of the woodworker George Nakashima?
Oh, yeah. George is amazing.
Yeah, who kind of has that similar, not trying to turn all of the wood into planks, but to let whatever the wood wants to be, try and capture that. Do you get one vision and then you're replicating it? It's that repetition. Is that how it starts off?
Yeah, so I usually start in the middle of the piece and then work my way out. The wood will show me one specific shape and then I'll draw that shape and work off of that one shape over and over and over and over and over and over and over again.
How long does it take you to do like that table that you showed us that's got sort of the circle?
Actually, that one was a really quick one. That one only took me 20 hours.
Oh, that seems pretty quick.
No, yeah, this one was a super fast one, but my piece Diligence was the one that took me the longest. This one took me absolutely forever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is incredible.
Yeah, that one took me forever. This is a piece that I'm working on currently.
Ooh.
Oh, how did you get all the different colors in that?
Yeah, so it's all just wood stain, just all different types of wood stain.
And then the black lines.
Yeah, so the black lines is my pyography.
Yeah, explain about that a little bit more, because I think that's a really cool thing.
Oh, yeah, super neat. So pyography is just writing with fire. So it's just this machine. It's basically like a soldering iron.
Mm-hmm.
You just choose your tip, whatever tip that you want, and you could burn pretty much anything you want. You could even do it on leather. So you could do it on leather or wood, whatever design that you want to do. But I learned about this machine from the same person that told me about sacred geometry. They were a woodworker and they made sculptures out of wood of the male form. And for money, he would make hearts for yard sales, for craft fairs and stuff like that. He would make little wooden hearts and he would burn.
Oh, somebody's name or.
Yeah, he would burn your heart is your compass now, or like something onto the wood. So I was like, how did you get it on there? And he showed me this tool. I was like, that's sick. So I bought one.
I noticed that there wasn't an eraser at the end of it. Have you ever made a mistake, or are there no mistakes and that it just becomes part of the design?
No, yeah, there can't be any mistakes. That's the one thing that is tough about my art, is because it's so precise and the pattern. I can't just turn it into a ear
flower.
Yeah, but if I do mess up, I just have to go in with like sandpaper and just sand it.
Oh, okay.
And just sand it down. So you just try not to mess up. But I do everything in pencil first, of course. So I'll do the design all in pencil and then do the burning and then the staining. And I use wood stain and pyrography because I want my pieces to age naturally, if that makes any sense. Over time, I want them to look like a part of nature.
Have you heard of the artist Andy Goldsworthy? He does similar things of installations in nature. And the whole idea is nobody touches it. Whatever happens to those rocks or whatever, that's part of the show. I think that's so cool. Yeah.
I love him. I get inspiration from him all the time, especially when I'm out and I'm on a hike. I always leave some kind of pattern in the leaves or the rocks or something like that along my way to leave my mark. I've been talking to a lot of artists and stuff like that about who's going to buy my art or where I'm going to show it and all this stuff. And people have told me that serious art collectors try to shy away from buying works on wood.
Oh.
Because I guess the wood tends to warp or whatever. So I was advised to coat my pieces in resin, but I'm not really wanting to do that because that'll take away from my vision. Because if I coat them in resin, then they'll never age. And I want them to age.
Mm-hmm.
When they fade, I want it to look like a geometric wood stump.
That was found. Yeah.
Yeah, like it was found.
Do you finish them with anything or?
Yeah, so I put just polyurethane over the top. Clear.
I know what you mean though, because sometimes you can see there'll be a really beautiful piece of wood and they'll have put a really thick layer of poly on top. And so you almost feel like you're looking at it through glass or something, and it doesn't have that kind of immediacy because it's so thick.
I don't want to put plastic over my beautiful wood, suffocating it. It needs to breathe. All of my works that you see on my website and everything between the rugs and my woodworking is all stuff that I just did this past year.
Wow. And again, that's christinakading.com, and it's christinakading.
Do you prefer working in wood over wool? It sounds like you do the wood first and then the rugs come after, or?
Yes, the rugs are for the people because I know that that is definitely going to sell. So all summer I was just pumping out those sheep rugs because it was for dollar bills, you know? So the rugs aren't my heart. The rugs aren't my art. This is my art, where the rugs is just something that I do as a little side hustle.
Mm-hmm.
And they did sell. Did you sell completely? Or?
I didn't sell completely out. I have 8 rugs left that are sitting here with me.
But how many did you bring to the show?
I brought 23.
Oh, wow.
I brought 23 and I walked out with 8. I did pretty good.
That's cool. Great. You were accepting commissions.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to tell us about your commissions?
Yeah, I'm super excited about the commissions, actually. So I had 42 people sign up for my little mailing list and that was interested in getting a commission and everything. But I only got, out of 42 people, I only had one lady follow through. But it was so much fun. She was, can you make a rug of my sister-in-law's cockatiel? I was like, absolutely. So she sent me a picture of the cockatiel and I was like, I can do it. So I had all the colors that I needed for the rug, different whites and grays and pink and tan. And I was so excited to like do something new, to make whatever in their little creative mind besides mine. It was nice to get out of my own regular work for a little bit and do something different. It was so much fun. And I just projected it and I traced it and I started tufting. And I was like, I'm just going to work on this for a couple hours, like 2 hours, whatever. And I banged out the whole rug in one night. It took me 6 hours. I just couldn't stop doing it. It was so much fun. I can't wait for my next commission. It was exciting to test my limits and like see what I am actually able to create. And it turned out incredible. I'm really, really happy with how it turned out. So I'm pretty excited to see what my next commission will be.
You should be. It's just adorable. I just love that. You can look at it on Instagram. It's really great.
My husband is a woodworker, and he's talked about that tension between, on the one hand, you need to sell stuff to make a living. So you need to figure out things that people are going to buy. But on the other hand, you want to be true to your own vision of what you think that this is about. And then you just hope and have faith that there'll be other people who will connect with your sacred geometry and be like, yeah, that speaks to me.
It definitely doesn't happen overnight, but you just got to keep following your heart. Keep just doing what you're doing. And if it makes you feel good, keep doing it. Doesn't matter how much money you get from it or anything like that. Your own happiness is priceless. And just to be able to say, like, I had this idea and I did this and I have it. And I'm so bad at selling my art. When anybody calls me or emails me, they're like, hey, can I buy this piece? I'm like, I guess it's kind of mine, but all right.
Hard to part with it.
You should have like a series of interview questions like, well, where are you going to put it? Is it in a good home with other things that it would like? I bet you'd sell even more stuff because it'd be like this club of, are you Christina Kading worthy? You know,
exactly. Like, is it going to a good home?
Yes.
Is it going to have a roof over its head and a warm meal every night?
Exactly. These are important considerations. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I know. Like, a lot of people are like, why don't you put it on Etsy or eBay? I was like, I don't want some drunk guy just clicking along eBay saying like, oh, that's cool, and then just buying it. That's not what it means to me. I want somebody to see it in person and be like, whoa, I need that.
And for it to speak to them, I think, to connect with the idea behind it. And I love how you explain that. Is there anything else that you feel like people should know about your work? I feel like we've kept you for a while.
I know, I have so many more questions.
You can ask more questions.
One thing that we haven't really touched on is, what has it been like? You know, traditionally sheep shearing is a male dominated field. I'm guessing woodworking maybe as well. I'm not sure. Yeah. About that one. How has that been for you?
It's been interesting. It's been hilarious, actually, because I'll get a phone call and I'll answer the phone. I'll be like, hello, it's Christina. They'll be like, hi, I'm trying to get my sheep sheared. Is this the right number? I'm like, yeah, what can I do for you? You know, they're like, all right. You know, and then they'll give me their address.
Do they ever say, is your dad there?
Yeah. Or just like, okay, you're the sheep shearer? Just by how my voice sounds, they're like, all right. And then I'll drive up to the farm and I'm 130 pounds and just like, whatever, wearing skinny jeans and a beanie, whatever, I'm here to shear your sheep. You know, I'm here to shear your alpaca. And they're like, you are? Yeah. So they'll always be like, hey, do you need any help? Do you need me to do anything? And the guys are super pushy. Like, they'll try to like get the sheep. I'm like, no, dude, just, it's good. It's better for you to just stand there. Just stay there and watch me do it. Just go. And then when they first meet me, they aren't like confident that I'm capable of doing this type of work. But then I prove them wrong very quickly.
And then what's their reaction afterwards?
They're pretty quiet. They just like walk away and then like let their wife handle it after that. They're like, oh shit, I couldn't do that.
Oh, interesting.
I did have this one client. It was actually kind of crazy. It was an alpaca shearing client in Pennsylvania, and they had a pretty big job. They had like 19 or 20 alpacas, and they hired me and my ex-wife to shear. So me and Ariana walk up into the farm, and right off the bat, they are judging us because we're gay. And it's like super rural, Republican, super straight Pennsylvania. So, and then this guy started saying that we didn't know what we were doing because we weren't doing what the guys that they hired last year did. We didn't have the same technique of getting them restrained. So we start doing this and this guy starts yelling and he's like, "You're not doing it right." I'm like, "Okay, Gary, how do you want to do it?" So he's like, "You gotta pick up the alpaca, pick it up, slam it down on the ground." So he wants us to pick up this 250-pound alpaca, slam it down on the ground, and then put the restraints on the legs. Okay. So I'm like, "I don't think so, buddy.
Oh my God.
That's not what we're going to do. But if you want to try doing it, you show me what you mean. Show me how you want to do it." So he's like, "You know what? I will. Watch this." So he's like, "Come here, Billy." His son was there. And so him and Billy are trying to pick up this alpaca and put it down on the ground like the other guys did last year. Gary ends up falling over, busting his ass. Billy's like, "I don't know what you're trying to do here, Dad. Like, they were doing fine without you." So me and Ariana are just standing there with our arms crossed, looking at Gary on the ground, rubbing his little boo-boo on his knee. I'm like, "How'd that feel, bud? Are you ready to let me and Ariana do what we do for a living? Huh? Huh?" He's like, "All right." And then he starts clipping the feet. He ended up trying to trim hooves and he ended up making the hoof bleed all over the place. So I'm like, "Gary, can you get the hell out of here? Okay. Mm. Just because we're women and we're gay doesn't mean that we're not capable of shearing an alpaca." So. So that was that, but usually it doesn't go that far. Usually if I walk up it, like, because I'm very confident in what I do, so as long as you walk up into the place like, "I'm here to do this job, move out of the way, people." I've been doing this since I was 8 years old, man. I was born on top of a sheep, you know.
When you were 8, did you at least get like a little sheep?
No, I have a picture somewhere. No, it was a regular old sheep.
Man, I'm just trying to picture this 8-year-old.
I know, and I either want the sheep to be small or I want you to be a big 8-year-old.
I was definitely not a big 8-year-old. I was. I could do it all, you know. She loves a challenge over here.
Yeah, but I love that you schooled Gary.
Gary.
I bet he's still talking about, "Remember when those two women came down and sheared all our alpacas and they were women?"
I know. They were women. Would you believe it?
I know. Would you believe it?
Would you believe it? Oh, my gosh. They weren't even here to clean the house. Shoot.
We read that the sheep shearers actually, I don't know if the statistics is really correct, but the day of shearing sheep burns twice as many calories as running a marathon.
It's true. I say that all the time. I say that every single time I shear a sheep. There is nothing that will make you sweat like bending over that sheep. It takes 30 seconds before you start sweating, sweating. I don't know. Yeah, it's a hard one. When I was in sheep shearing school, they were like, "It is the second hardest job in the world next to jackhammering."
Oh,
huh. Interesting.
Right?
Well, I do usually have a pop culture moment. And there is that scene from Thornbirds, the 1980s miniseries, where they're shearing the sheep and they are sweaty. I noticed that they were very accurate on the sweaty part. What did you think about that scene? You know, which I should explain that to our listeners. Hi, Mom.
Yeah. Hi, Mom.
That we made Christina watch the scene from Thornbirds that has the, when the sheep shearers come to the farm, I think it's in Australia, and they show them in the barn. Is that pretty accurate? Do they have music in the background like that when you shear?
Do you ever sing?
They sing, sing on your way.
Are you kidding me? They're singing all the time. Yes. No, yeah, it's very accurate. The barn scene where they're all shearing together is definitely how it looks, especially when they're all singing up to the house and all the women were like, "Oh, look at that one. He's pretty cute." I get that all the time. I don't know. Sheep shearers are just irresistible. Yeah. Irresistible to men and women. We're just hypnotized to people with our loving, gentle sheep shearing skills. I don't know what it is.
But it gets them every time.
I love that because it gives me a whole new appreciation for that scene in Thornbirds and mm-hmm. how and the verisimilitude of it, how much it really captured the allure of sheep shearers.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's the sweaty. They were not wearing a lot of clothes and, you know, the glistening.
Yeah. And the big tufts of wool.
I'm actually allergic to lanolin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So when I was a little girl and my dad would come home from shearing and pick me up out of the crib or whatever, I would break out in hives when he touched me. Mm-hmm. And everybody thought that I was just allergic to Donald. But it turns out that I'm allergic to lanolin, but I'm not allergic to alpacas because they don't have any oil in their fiber. So yeah, so whenever I shear a sheep, it doesn't matter whether it's 90 degrees outside, I need to be wearing long sleeves and long pants so I don't break out in hives.
The special shoes, right?
No, I don't go for the special shoes. I did get the special shoes when I was in sheep shearing school.
Oh.
I don't really shear that many sheep. So like I could see if you needed to shear like 100 sheep, then you could use the moccasins and stuff like that. But since I'm only doing small flocks, I just wear my regular booties.
Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, for sure. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, this was just wonderful. So much information.
Yeah, and just sharing your experience and the allure of the sheep shearer.
I know. I can't wait till shearing season comes again. I'm always bored in the wintertime.
But you have all your other arts that you can do. It yeah. seems like a nice rhythm, you know, right about the time that you're maybe getting tired of that stuff, it's time to shear sheep.
Yep, it's true. Yep, yeah. Exactly. When I'm not doing art and when I'm not shearing sheep, I'm behind the bar mixing up drinks.
Oh, you're a mixologist?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's what they say out in Seattle.
Don't they say that in New York?
Yeah. Oh, they do?
Yeah. That's a real thing.
Okay.
That's a real thing.
Do you want to give us a cocktail recipe? You know, we're Booty and Bossy Eat, Drink, Knit. So we would.
Yeah, what's your favorite cocktail?
My favorite cocktail right now is a jade gimlet, but it's a fake gimlet because it's made with cucumber vodka. It's supposed to be gin, but we'll let that go.
Okay.
If you have fresh basil,
okay,
cucumber, gin or vodka, fresh lime juice, shake that up. Gorgeous.
Mm.
Gorgeous little drink. Get some basil in there, muddle the basil, little bit of lime, simple syrup if you like it sweet. And it's just such a good, refreshing drink.
Do you muddle the cucumber or what? How do you just put the cucumber in?
You can muddle the cucumber and the basil on the thing and strain out the seeds. But you never shake gin. So if you're using vodka, shake it. But if you're using gin, stir it.
Okay. What would you say is the proportion of like gin to lime juice? You can see we've all of a sudden gotten very serious.
Yes, about a quarter. So maybe 2 ounces of gin and then 1 ounce of lime juice. Depends on your own flavor. If you like it sour or if you like it sweet, I use 2 ounces of gin and 1 ounce of lime juice. But either way, it turns out good because of that basil. That basil will make anything taste delicious.
Mm.
So good. And of course, it's espresso martini season.
Mm.
So I've been making a lot of those because it happens every time. If somebody sits down at the bar with their group of friends and their group of friends had whatever they wanted in mind, like one of them, you know, usually gets a gin and tonic or the other one gets an old fashioned. If one person out of the group orders an espresso martini, they're all going to get one. They're really like, actually, that sounds good. Make me one too. So whenever anybody comes in with a group and orders an espresso martini, I just look at them all. I'm like, how many of those am I making?
What's in an espresso martini? I don't think I've actually ever had that.
Oh, man. You've never had an espresso martini?
I don't think I have.
Oh my gosh. It's the best drink ever.
And I like coffee.
Oh yeah. Boy. Make yourself an espresso martini today. So.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be. Do you have an espresso machine? You don't need one. But at home, I make my coffee strong anyway. So I just use my leftover if you got cold coffee from this morning or whatever.
I do have that.
Use that cold coffee that you got sitting in your coffee pot. 2 ounces of coffee, 2 ounces of Kahlua, 2 ounces of vodka. Shake that up nice and good. Put it in a martini glass. You'll get this nice foam on top.
You got yourself an espresso martini and a good rest of your afternoon to boot.
I knew there was a reason I didn't go to work today, because I see an espresso martini in my future. Yeah.
So I think that's an incredible plan.
Well, now we don't have to do our recipe. This is awesome. We've covered our pop culture moment. We've covered not one, but two drinks.
Hell yeah.
Thank you again so much for sharing all of your experience. And we love your work. And we love how you've connected all these things through sacred geometry. And it's just really wonderful to talk with you and inspiring. And you just need to keep doing you, and the people will come.
Yeah, exactly. All it takes is time and patience.
Exactly.
All right, my loves.
Whatever you do, don't knit
like my sister. But do shear a sheep like Christina Katie.
Thank you, guys.